Going Linux, episode 244, Computer America, number 73. Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy. Whether you are new to Linux, upgrading from Windows to Linux, or just thinking about moving to Linux, this podcast will provide you with valuable information and advice that will help you in Going Linux. We hope that you'll find this and all our episodes helpful in learning about Linux and its applications and using them to get things done. In today's episode, Computer America.
You're listening to Computer America.
Hello and welcome into the Computer America show. It's the nation's longest running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. Computer America's heard around the world and coast to coast. And I'm your host, Craig Crossman.
And I'm your co-host, this time hiding behind the Computer America logo with Charles Tindall. Charles Tindall.
Oh, so you're having firewall problems just like me, huh?
That's not, well, no. Your camera works.
Yeah.
You just have the webcam firewall enabled.
I see. And your, what happened to your webcam? Last time it was all the USB ports on the left side of the computer were not running.
Yeah. Oh, they're on the right side of the computer. We're not running.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm hoping that my baby is not dying because this is she's a few years old, but she was future proofed or future resistant.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just little weird things have been quirking out here the last day or so, and it's sad.
Well, maybe it's time to move over to the Chromebook or something.
Yeah, I can't move to the Chromebook permanently. There's things that I need my big machine to do.
Okay. So if this keeps happening, then you think that it's slowly dying and you need to get another computer or what?
I hope not. I mean, I've got plans to upgrade to a MacBook Pro to take over for this machine.
Ooh.
But the problem is I'm not one of those people who are like, oh, look, MacBook Pro, let's go backwards to save money.
Mm-hmm.
No. If I'm going to get a MacBook Pro, it's got to be the exact same specs as this one, which means it's got to have, you know, 16 gigs of RAM, which, you know, I can get the RAM from Otherworld Computing.
Yes, you can.
You know, it's got to have a seriously large solid state hard drive, or at least a decent size, 256 gigabytes mm-hmm. at a minimum, solid state hard drive. And, you know, in honor of what we are doing tonight, it for damn sure will be dual booting Ubuntu.
Yeah. Just, Now, this is the Mac Mini that's dying, or?
No. My primary machine is my Linux machine,
okay.
And I love that machine.
Well, you've been using your Mac Mini before, you know, and that's why you upgraded it from Otherworld Computing to have all those. So why can't you use the Mac Mini?
Nothing's hooked up to the Mac Mini at this point.
Ah, okay. Well,
I'm using the Mac Mini right now to do graphic design and a few other things.
Okay.
I'm happy with the Mac Mini, the Mini Mac. Mm-hmm. But it is true that if I do upgrade to a MacBook Pro to replace my primary machine, the Mac Mini is going away. So, you know, stay tuned to the Computer America listeners. You might get a slightly used, pretty much new Mac Mini with a solid-state hard drive upgrade and several gigs of RAM.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go.
Maybe. I have to clear it by the wife first, you know. You know how that one works.
Yes, I do. And, of course, this is now before we get started, just a couple of brief notes here. We're starting a new segment here tonight on Computer America. We've had the London Minute in Hour 1 and Hour 2. So what we're going to do is in the first hour of the show now, we're going to start having something I call the News Tips Bulletin. And this is actually done by the editor of the News Tips Bulletin, Marty Winston. He's going to do a two-minute segment that'll be in the first hour of each show. And then, of course, we'll have Patricia Reichel's London Minute in the hour two of the program. So and we're going to see how that works out. And for the first one, Marty's actually giving me four segments that all have to be played in the first week. So I think tonight we'll do part one, part two, tomorrow night, part three, Thursday night, and part four, Friday night.
When did this change happen?
This just happened now. So we're going to see.
Nobody updates the Charles.
You know, well, it just happened so quickly that, so anyway, we're going to give it a try. And he's going to obviously gonna have tech things, but sometimes he's going to do tech that is not necessarily computer tech. He has other technology items. And I would tell you what this one's about, but I think I'm just going to let it speak for itself and let me know what you think, okay? Because it's kind of interesting. And we'll see. And then, of course, from the weeks after, we'll just have one news tip bulletin every week. Marty will give one of those a week, and then of course we'll have Patricia Reichel in with her one London Minute in a week. So we'll see how everything goes. All right. So that's coming up tonight. You'll see here that at the bottom of the hour break. And so let's see, anything else that we need to get started before we get started? Anything else you want to mention, Charles?
The world is coming to an end, but we'll get to that in another story during news.
Well, okay, it's the third Tuesday of the month. That means it's time for Linux. Linux operating system continues to be more and more popular. And it's an important operating system, so every month we devote an entire Computer America show to the subject of Linux. And if you have a Linux question, tonight's the night for you to give us a call. Now, joining us is our Linux expert, Larry Bushy. Larry is the creator and host of the Going Linux podcast. Hey, Larry, welcome to Computer America. How are you?
I'm living the dream.
Oh, gosh.
Wait, which kind of dream is that? Because, you know, there's one on your shirt.
Yeah, that's the one on my shirt. Let me just get up here a little bit so people can see it. There it is.
Yep, live your dream. Yeah. Breakthrough fences.
Actually, I don't see any. I don't see you now. You just went off. All I see is the penguin now, Larry. So you disappeared.
Penguin? Oh, I think it's Craig's failure because I see Larry.
Oh, you see him? Well, I'm not
seeing him. I see Larry's smiling face.
Oh, that's interesting, because I'm not seeing Larry at all. That's bizarre.
I think it's your fault. I think I blame you, Craig.
It's because you're hiding behind that fog.
Yeah, exactly.
So what you got to do, Craig, now is to enable video for all users, you have to disable your webcam firewall.
Okay.
By disabling your webcam firewall, you will find yourself able to clearly see everyone.
Uh-huh. Now, by the way,
it speeds up your internet connection too. By the way,
if you have a comment or question or suggestion about anything we're talking tonight, give us a call at 347-884-8881. That's 347-884-8881. We'll get you on and get you through. Email live live at computeramerica.com. If you don't want to go in the air, it's a great way to get your question posted. You can also join us in the live interactive add-on chat room from our homepage at computeramerica.com. You'll see there's a button there that says chat room /video. It's also under the first pull-down menu. Either one will work. You'll see the chat room on that page, and it'll ask you for a username. That's the name you'll be known by when you go into the chat room. Click the sign-in button, and your Java-enabled browser on the Windows machine, Mac, Linux, they all work. Trust me, they do. We'll move you into the Computer American chat room. And on that same page, you also can watch the Computer America show. That's right. We now have live Computer America video streaming that shares the page with our chat room, but it's all there.
Actually, you want to know something that's even more entertaining?
What?
That I'm testing out right now?
What?
We are using something that you asked me to guide you through and asked me to help set you up on and figure out how to do it for you. I'm actually running on ProXPN right now.
Whoa, so you have a VPN up and running?
Yep, I've got the VPN, and it's actually not hurting anything. And see, if I hadn't said anything, you wouldn't even know, now would you?
No, you sound great. I can't see you, but you do sound great.
That has nothing to do with my internet connection. My internet connection is beautiful. It is actually running very well. It's weird. It's most VPNs that I've run on you name it. I've been on a bunch of different ones, but most of the ones that I run on, they've either A, got a bandwidth cap, or B, they've got, you know, it's just you're connected to someone else's servers, you know, you're doing all these different things, you know, and it becomes, you know, it bogs you down. You're just like, and you notice the speed difference. I haven't yet. And I mean, I'm doing things like I've got my BitTorrent, not BitTorrent. I've got my Bitcoin wallet up and syncing. I'm over on the Computer America website, about to log into the chat room. I'm developing our newest website. It's holding up. I think I've even got a scan running. But you know, I need to review some of their privacy policies to see what they do. But so far, I'm pretty impressed.
Yeah,
and this is all running on your Linux machine, right?
Oh yeah, Larry, I can walk you through it. If you don't have OpenVPN or PPTP capability, which you should, you're on Mint, right?
Yes, I'm on Mint, and PPTP is there. And in fact, I've signed up for ProXPN as well.
Whoa, good man! All right,
yeah.
And
so I've tried set it up, and it's and it's not quite set up yet, so I was hoping.
Well, you know, what
would share on the Hangout, and Charles, you could help us out with it.
Yeah, and sure. Not only that, I don't know if you're signing up for ProXPN, there's a special code that you can use that will, no matter which membership you get, it'll save you like 20% off. Forever.
Now you tell me.
Forever. You can still do it. You can say, just put the key code is COMPAM, COMPAM, COMPAM. And that's
COMPAM. COMPAM. Okay.
And that will, you just apply that to it and you'll be up and running. And that's true. If you, any of their ProXPN price, in other words, they have three different plans. They have the 3-month subscription, the 6-month subscription, and the 12-month subscription. And, so if you,
wait, are we on the special one? Did they give us like a special VPN one for us?
Yes, exactly. See, if you go there normally, the 3-month subscription would be $9.98 a month. The 6-month subscription is $8.33 per month, and the 12-month subscription is $6.25 a month. But if you put in the Comp M and hit the apply the code, what happens is that the 3-month subscription drops down to $7.99 per month, 6 months, $6.66 a month, and the 12-month subscription, which you really should do for the 12 months, that's $5 a month, so $60 a year, and that's not just that one time, but you're locked into that. You have that. That's forever. You know, so every year you'll be paying $5 a month to get ProXPN. Really terrific deal, and we have an arrangement with them to do that. So if you think, look, then we're going to be talking about what a VPN is throughout this hour, and we're going to be talking, see, because Larry comes up with a topic that we're going to discuss on every show, and tonight's topic is using a VPN with your Linux. Okay, that's what we're going to do. We're going to do that this hour, and I suggested to Larry that he try it out and everything, so he can talk about it. And of course, Charles has a Linux machine too. And obviously, it works extremely well. Of course, it'll work with Mac. It'll work with Windows.
Well, mm-hmm. Actually, you know, because I know ProXPN, they're out there listening right now. I think you guys, if you need help developing a Deb or an other easier to configure Linux, you know, script, I can help you. I am a shell script ninja.
Okay.
And actually, you know what, Larry? I might do that if I can find some available time, because I know you're on Mint, so I might use you as a guinea pig if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all. In fact, I have Linux Mint 17 in a virtual machine, and that's
the newest one, right?
It is the newest one. I've got the release candidate, so that's why I've got it in a virtual machine rather than installed. So, and I've got ProXPN. Kind of, sort of set up, and we'll fix it live on the air today, and people can watch it in action, I hope.
Yeah, exactly. And so, again, just for the for an overview, for those who have not been familiar with what a VPN is, Charles, or do you want to explain what it is, or Larry, either one. What do either one of you can take it if you'd like.
Well, a VPN, Larry, unless you want to jump in on this one.
No, go ahead.
A VPN is a virtual private network, and what it basically does, I can't get my SIM card tray out, oh no. What it basically does is it routes all your internet traffic through someone else's infrastructure into someone else's systems, basically making you next to untraceable on the interwebs.
Okay, so let me play the devil's advocate here. So my internet signals are all going through somebody else's server. Can they see it?
They probably can. I mean, if it's sitting on their servers and your traffic is encrypted between you and that server, there has to be a request made from that server on your behalf. So they could, if somebody really, 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 really wanted to, they could essentially go ahead and pull that information and be like, oh, the request came from this source and it was going to this destination and it was fed like this. They could do that if they really wanted to.
Okay.
I mean, but then again, organizations like ProXPN and a couple of the other ones, they are all of the opinion that the reason you're getting a VPN is so that you can do things online and not have to worry about whether somebody else is spying on you.
Right.
So, you know, it would kind of defeat the purpose for them to have, you know, for them to have, for them to spy on you themselves.
Oh yeah. And, you know, there's the best explanation I have yet to see on what a VPN is actually on the ProXPN website. It's right on their main webpage, proxpn.com, and it's right in the top right, right above the fold in newspaper terms. And that little video describes it in layman's terms, what a VPN is and what it does for you and why you should have one.
That is exactly it. It's extremely informative. It explains how it works and what a VPN is, and for those who might not even know what it, or have ever heard of it before, and what it can do. And again, as I said, I wanted to talk about this tonight with Larry because Larry is our Linux correspondent and is extremely knowledgeable about the subject of Linux. And it's interesting that things like ProXPN that will work with Linux. That was one of the first things I said. I said, hey, look, I understand they have a Mac version and I understand they have a Windows version. I said, will it work with Linux? And evidently it does. Now it uses, it's one of the things that they use with Android, the Android operating system, which was the PT.
Point tunneling protocol.
I have to point this out because clearly written on the ProXPN website, it's not officially supported. So,
right.
You know, going down this path, first of all, if you're running Linux and you want to set up a VPN using PPTP, you're clearly an advanced user. You know, the functionality is there. It's just not that simple to do.
Okay.
Right. It's not that difficult. It's just not pre-set up as it is on the Windows and the Mac client. Looking at the Mac setup instructions from ProXPN, it's not really all that different from setting it up on the Mac, quite frankly.
Well, yeah, and not only that, again, now this might be a stereotype, but I've always felt that people who like Linux like to tinker a little bit, right? They like to get into it, right?
But you don't have to.
Okay.
We're just the cool kids, that's all.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
But and we can get into this more as we move forward on this, but the bottom line with ProXPN as a VPN, and I have to say that there are free open source VPN solutions out there, like OpenVPN. And ProXPN talks about an OpenVPN on their website, and I'm not sure that they're talking about the same thing. OpenVPN is the name of a VPN client and server and a bunch of other stuff that is specific to open source, whereas ProXPN's is a proprietary VPN service, which isn't all bad when you're talking about having security, but the ProVPN offers a free version, which is, it has most of the features you would need for a standard VPN connection, with the glaring exception that in order to get PPTP, which you have to have to get the Linux networking to work or VPN to work, you need to have the premium account. They have PPTP in their premium services only. So I signed up for premium and I'm giving it a try on my Linux box. And the nice thing about Linux is the network manager in Linux is, well, that too. A nice thing about Linux is that the network manager that comes on many Linux distributions already has VPN capabilities and PPTP capabilities already installed. So you really don't have to install anything. So in other words, there is no ProXPN client that you have to install.
That's nice.
You don't need it. And you really just need to be able to configure the network manager correctly, that is. And that's one of the things that I put in the show notes, the instructions that I actually got from Ferdy at the 24/7 help desk for ProXPN. He sent me an email with these instructions. I followed them to the letter, and there are a few letters missing. So maybe we can figure it out.
Yeah, and that's another thing about ProXVM. They do have I think it's 24/7 tech support. So if you need help, you can get a live person to actually help you with this. And again, Larry, I hope you go back or if you've done it and put in the coupon code COMPAMP, because it's going to take it down. Now, they do give you a free trial with it too. So if you, you can try it and see if you like it, and 7-day risk-free trial. And, don't like it, you're not the worst,
Right.
Really?
The free trial is the free account, which doesn't have PPTP. So for Linux folks, that's probably not going to work for you.
Okay.
But for Windows and Mac folks, that'll work just fine as a trial.
Well, yeah, but the premium account, though, comes with the 7-day risk-free trial. So if you can try you can try the premium account for 7 days, and if you want, there's no hurt. There's no fuss,
okay.
No mess.
Okay, well, that's great. That's wonderful.
So that's
then I've got 7 days to try this out and it works. And but no, I've signed up. I paid for it. So I'll use your coupon code when I renew.
Okay. All right. Good. All right. So so let's get started with this. Now again, you just started using this today, Charles. You put it in and you've been using it. So let's talk a little bit more about this. Now, how would I use ProXVM? How is it going to I don't know, protect me or you know?
Well, you're not cool enough yet, so there's that.
Yeah.
Actually, how you would use it, say a lot of people have problems with their ISP, with net neutrality and everything else that's going on. Your ISP detects the traffic that you're using and it throttles you. Right, they're like, oh, look, Craig is using Netflix religiously. Yeah, exactly. Larry's got a throttle to you.
Yeah, exactly.
It chokes the life out of you, and mm-hmm. and it's the same problem with various different connections in your area. So ProXVM and VPNs in general help with that. So now your ISP has no idea what you're doing on their wire, so they can't actually restrict you or lose their mind and do anything retarded on your stuff. The other benefit of that is if you live in a country, Egypt, for example, where you can't get certain websites because they're blocked by your at an ISP level, ProXVM alleviates that problem. It routes you through different servers. It routes you through different places. In this case, the ones in the U.S. and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So you can get access to those websites that are otherwise blocked.
That's very cool.
Oh, we love it.
Yeah,
The other good one is anonymity online. Everybody hears about the tracking and I'm still, oh my God. I did a Google search because a friend of mine got me one of these, a Zag case to check out,
mm-hmm.
the Zag Folio. Mm-hmm. I like it. I I've got my Logitech, ultra thin one. It's nice, but the Zag is slightly, it's different for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I punched that in inadvertently to a Google search engine, and now anytime I go anywhere, I get the Zag ads, I get the Zag video on YouTube, I get the Amazon ads, and I'm like, dear God, go away! VPNs alleviate that, so they can't actually track you. So from one session to the next, it can't pop up and be like, hey, you looked at this 5 days ago. I'm sure you're still interested in it. You should buy it. And typically people like me are like, go away.
like the most aggressive salesperson you can ever imagine, and then multiply that by 10. Exactly.
So now, Charles, my work has a VPN.
Uh-huh.
So on my MacBook, I connect through the VPN to work. Am I to assume that I can't piggyback a VPN on a VPN? In other words, if I'm using ProXVM as my household VPN connection to the internet, could I tunnel through that tunnel with work VPN, or does that not work?
Absolutely. You can go.
It does work.
You can go certain layers down. You can go as deep as you want to go. Just remember, in Inception, the dream gets very unstable the deeper you go. So, I wouldn't recommend it because
yeah.
your, I mean, the the clients on your Mac are going to collide. They're going to be like, we're both trying to establish this connection, so on and so forth. So it's theoretically and physically possible with a little finessing and a little work. But, I mean, like, for example, you've got it, you've got Ubuntu in a virtual machine. So if you were to VPN in on Mac on the OS X side, right, or the OS X side, and then VPN your Ubuntu virtual machine through that same tunnel, it's going to work. It's going to work for you. It's going to work like a champ. You know, you might notice a little bit of slowdown, you know, depending on your work and depending on the connection levels. But, you know, again, the dream gets unstable the deeper you go. You're going to notice some instability when you start stacking VPNs on top of one another.
Just a thought for those people who are using this in a work environment as well. Yeah.
However, I'm looking for, however, now I want to be like, okay, so I want to see how deep this rabbit hole is.
How many times can VPN through a VPN through a VPN?
It's guaranteed that it's guaranteed that you're never going to catch me. But then again, remember, if you watched Edward Snowden and the Southwest
16 different ones or something? Yeah, 16 different...
He was through 16 different VPNs and proxies. He was like, we're going to make sure you ain't catching me. You know?
Wow. And they weren't able to catch him.
You know, it's entertaining. You know, people ask me all the time, would you go after and try and catch people like Edward Snowden? And I, without blinking, I tell them not a chance in hell. He did something that should have been done in the first place. You know, you shouldn't have been trying to spy on your own citizens. You shouldn't have been lying to the people who gave you the ability to do what you do. And, you know, the governments derive their power from the governed, you know, and I think he's a patriot. He outed a dysfunctional system, and it just elaborates the fact that he is kind of a patriot because, quite honestly, the government is after him. They're like, you screwed us. No, we didn't. You screwed yourself.
Mm. Yeah. So Jonathan in the chat just said, for me, I use incognito mode through Tor. Now, incognito mode is just going to cause the browser not to save cookies and such. Right. Does Tor give you the kind of protection that the VPN does?
Yes, but it's slower.
Okay.
It's slower. Well, unless you've got dedicated exit nodes that you know about, right? If there are two different types of Tor networks. There's the mainstream network that everybody who's worried about security does. They're paranoid. They jump on Tor. They install a plugin and they run through it. And then there are the secret nodes where you have to know a guy who knows a guy who knows two other guys that might give you the information to connect to this one system to find out about the other one.
Right. Right.
Those are all designed to be ridiculously fast, but there are only at any given time a couple of hundred people on them versus a couple of thousand people from the main Tor network.
Wow.
Got it.
And again, you can avoid all that with something like a Pro XVN because for $5 a month, you get really unlimited
speed. If you're paranoid enough to be playing in Tor and to do multiple layers of VPN, I mean, I need to go over to ProXVN's website and I need to review their privacy terms because there are VPN providers out there who are like, you know, we do provide you this VPN for your privacy to the major corporate entities, but if Joe Fed even knocks on our door and is asking for a cup of sugar, we're going to deliver him your information.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a cup of sugar and here's Craig's information.
ProXPN was on the show. I know you were not on that program, but that question came up, and we were assured that the privacy is maintained.
You can view that on ProXPN's blog site. They have it posted there from, when is it, May 17th? Huh? Or May 7th.
Yeah, exactly. So your anonymity is assured. Oh, wow, time is flying. We're at the bottom of the hour already? Okay.
We are.
All right. Well, hey, we're going to have that new segment coming up from Marty Winston's editor of the News Tip Bulletin. That's going to be coming up right after these commercial messages. It's our All Linux Show with Larry Bushy, and Charles and I are talking about VPN, specifically Pro XVN, and we will continue on right after this. Stay with us.
As an editor and reviewer, I get lots of products in, and it takes real work to figure out what makes some better than others. There's a category that's pretty popular right now, but where there's a lot of confusion that I hope to help straighten out. This is about LED flashlights. Here's the ultimate question, one that's vexed mankind forever. How do you cure darkness? For a long time, the best answer was a full moon, or maybe waiting for daylight. But Shazam, technology stepped in, and mankind started using an amazingly useful new development called fire. It's come a long way since the first release version. Advances led to very useful inventions like torches, candles, and lanterns. Then came unfire in the hands of Edison. He tamed fire by running electricity through a wire while taking away oxygen, so it couldn't combust but could incandesce. Since then, others came up with different ways to create luminescence. For example, they used ultraviolet light to make phosphorus glow in fluorescent lighting, still with a little fire in the wire. But then the semiconductor industry figured out ways to get changes in energy states at the atomic level to spit out photons. And the light-emitting diode was born. These days, we just say LED. In its early years, you mostly just saw LEDs as small red dots used as pilot lights or indicator lights. Over time, they managed other colors and more brightness and greater efficiency. The toughest color, the one that took the longest to make happen, was blue. We've had that for a while now. Ready for a surprise? There's no such thing as a white LED. When you see white light coming from an LED light bulb or an LED flashlight, you're seeing the result of a blue to ultraviolet LED exciting a usually yellow phosphor to make that white glow happen. So what happens when you put that into a flashlight? We'll get into that next time. This is Marty Winston at the News Tips Bulletin reporting for Computer America.
Hey.
Wow. That's new.
Yeah.
I have to go look that one up.
Yeah. I mean, he's going to have some really interesting things on technology. Right now he's doing LED flashlights, and he's going to follow it up. It's a four-parter then we're this week, and then we're going to go back to one a week with him. But I think it's really kind of interesting, and he's going to do all kinds of things.
This is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jonathan in the chat says it's a documentary on LEDs.
Right?
Exactly. Well, there you go. It's a good way to put it. All right.
2 minutes last a long time on the radio.
It does. Me, I was thinking, wow, I got time to eat more of my sandwich. I'm good.
Well, welcome back, Charles. Are you going to bring it back?
I thought I did. But anyway, welcome back to the Computer America Show. Craig and I are talking to Larry Bushy. I'm still like, wow, that's really new. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking about Linux. This is our all Linux show. It's my second favorite show that we do every month. And I bet neither of you can guess which is the first favorite.
The Hacker Show.
Nope. The Hacker Show is not my favorite. It's not my favorite because the Hacker Show is me spending the whole time talking.
Mm-hmm. Well, it must be the news segments then.
Actually, my favorite show between my favorite two right now are you and Sandy Berger.
Ah, yes, hey. we had Sandy on last night. Yeah.
I like Sandy when she's on because Sandy's not one of those people who are like, oh, this is great, it's shiny, and that's why I like it. No, she's truly like, the hardware sucks. It's a great concept, but the hardware sucks. You know, this is where they could improve. And it's straight from the tap, you know, consumer expert opinions and things. And I enjoy that. So.
Linux sucks.
Yeah.
Is that better?
Hey, wait, hold on. Larry, tell me, does this sound like a phone hanging up?
No.
Anyway, welcome back to the Computer America Show. Craig, Larry, and I are having a good time. We're talking about all things Linux. We just finished a whole first hour segment about ProXVN. If you're worried about your privacy, go get it. And it's not nearly as complicated as a lot of people think it is because, you know, people are like, oh, my God, it's something else I have to learn. But not necessarily.
No.
I'm actually waiting for when they have the setup. And with the following the PPTP instructions, you can actually set it up into like a DDWRT router. But that's way more advanced. And that's like a 3 hour show. So.
Yeah, that's a 4-letter acronym, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
we're limited
to 3-letter acronyms on this show.
Yeah, but on a Windows machine and the Mac, I know for sure. I mean, it's really simple. It just puts a little logo up in the upper right-hand corner, and you're done. You just turn it on or turn it off, and it's just that simple.
Yeah, it's because they're providing you a client, and
that's
the client
right.
is pre-configured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
With Linux, that you've got your own client already, and mm-hmm. you need to configure it.
Mm-hmm. You are the client.
You are the client.
There is no spoon. Anyway, if you want to get in on this conversation, you want to talk to me, you want to talk to Larry, you've got a Linux question, you've got a Pro XVN question, if you're worried, you've got any type of question whatsoever, you know, Craig's got them all. My wife, Dee's got any type of Groupon question you might want to ask. You know, we're all over the place. You know, Cynthia, she's got questions. She's got answers for, like, porcelain figurines and, like did you ever find your gecko?
No. The gecko disappeared.
Yeah, they're still hot on that trail. But if you got a question, give us a call, 347-884-8881. That number again, 347-884-8881. I'll get you on and get you through. Or shoot us an email, live@computeramerica.com, or join us over at computeramerica.com in our live interactive add-on chat room. I'm there. Larry's there. Addison, Jonathan, all of our great people. Fort, one of my other favorite ones, is in there. And we're all having fun, having a good time talking about stuff. Also, right above our live interactive add-on chat room, you get to see Larry, who's got the Computer America webpage up on his screen sharing.
Yeah, we're
right
seeing,
on the Linux Mint.
Okay. For some reason, I think I got dropped from the Hangout. Wow.
No, you didn't drop. I kicked you out.
You did?
Oh, what a guy.
Well, it's called a hostile takeover.
Well, for some reason, yeah, I can't. Let me see what's going on here. And why I can't get back in. Okay, well, I'm in.
You're in the Hangout.
Yeah, I'm in the Hangout, but for some reason I got booted temporarily. And
you just go to the chat room. You just click on the little thingy here.
No, don't do that.
And then you can see it. There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, wait.
Why did that happen?
How did you get that video to go?
How do I get the video to go?
How deep can you get that video to go? See, now you're on the Computer
America
page.
Oh, I don't know.
Page.
Yes,
in the video.
Let me turn the...
on the page,
yes.
The video is the Computer
there
America.
Now. There we go.
We're going to now go further down the rabbit hole because it's going to be a video of a video.
Of the video.
Oh, no.
There we go.
And you're running VirtualBox, it looks like.
Yes, it's VirtualBox. And
nice.
This is Linux Mint 17, and which is in release candidate right now. It should be released to full production this month, and I have done very few tweaks to this in VirtualBox, but let's see here. So if I have not installed anything
it's actually pre-installed, so all you have to do is select Allow, and you're good.
Yes, so did I select Allow, or did I select Cancel?
No, the drop-down right there, up. Here, give me your mouse.
Yes. Oh, I know. Here we go. Block plugin, Allow. Yes, and remember, there we go. So Iced-T, this thing you see here, is the, it's instead of hot coffee as in Java, it's Iced-T.
Ah.
And so that is the plugin that allows you to, oops, I should have hit trust. No, that worked. Okay.
And for the record, Iced-T doesn't have any of the other vulnerabilities that normal Java has.
So there you go. So we could log right into the chat room here. So this is just as it comes out of the tin with, let's just minimize that for a minute in case we want to go in there. So this is Linux Mint 17 with the Cinnamon desktop.
Nice. That's the traditional one. That's the one that it normally ships with, isn't it?
Well, there's the Mate one, or the one described as Mate, which is more like GNOME 2.
Yeah.
So, Cinnamon's a lot more modern looking. In terms of it's got effects, and you can change the effects around a little more than you can on the Mate one. But what was I going to say here? Yeah, so this the reason I wanted to highlight Mint 17 is because it's a long-term support release. It's actually supported through 2019.
Isn't this the first one that Mint has done?
No, they've done long-term support releases coincident with the Ubuntu ones. They've been based on Ubuntu. Now, the difference here, though, is that starting with this release, this long-term support release, until their next long-term support release, they're going to continue to base Linux Mint not off of the 6 months releases from Ubuntu, but rather on the current long-term support release of Ubuntu. So although Ubuntu itself will be long-term support, and then I think it's two or three interims and then another long-term support, Linux Mint will be long-term support, and then I guess Mint, I think they're going to call it 17.1 rather than 18, if I read the blog post correctly. It'll still be based on the long-term support release of Ubuntu that's currently here. So Ubuntu and Linux Mint will get out of sync until.
So let me make sure I'm understanding what you're saying here.
Yep.
So Mint is going to stop doing what they've been doing, which is releasing a new Mint version every time Ubuntu releases a new cutting edge one, and they're only going to release or incremental updates to their long term release platform.
Yeah, not quite. Here's the way it works. So Linux Mint 16 was based on Ubuntu 13.10.
Uh-huh.
Right? So now Ubuntu updates to a long-term support release, 14.04. Linux Mint 17 long-term support is based on 14.04. So here's where the change occurs. The next version of Linux Mint, if they had followed the old process, would have been based on 14.10, the next version of Ubuntu, which is not a long-term support. But what they've decided to do, they're going to release it about the same time, but they're going to continue to have it based on 14.04, even though Ubuntu will be on 14.10. That will add a measure of stability to the next version of Linux Mint, because it's still based on the long-term support release, and so they should have better support for Linux Mint, better stability for Linux Mint in the versions between Mint 17 and whatever the next long-term support version will be a couple of years from now.
Okay.
So it's in the interest of stability. I haven't read that anywhere on the blog post, but that's my assumption. Is it's in the interest of keeping Linux Mint more stable, more supportable. And because they're basing future versions of the Linux Mint on a stable platform, and the longer it goes, the more stable 14.04 Ubuntu will be, that allows them to spend more time improving things like Cinnamon and the other features of Linux Mint, because they've got a stable platform to work from.
Okay.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense, huh?
Yeah.
So, in the show notes, we have some of the information about the various versions of Linux Mint. So if we go to Linux Mint and we go to their blog here, we've got some information on this Linux Mint 17, Kiana, and there's a link to this Mate release candidate article here, and then there's also a link to the scroll, the Cinnamon RC version. Now there's a third version of Linux Mint typically that they release, and that's the XFCE version. I haven't seen that they've released the release candidate yet for XFCE. It does tend to lag a little bit, so the Mate version and Cinnamon version will go into production first, most likely. So you may be asking, what are the improvements in Linux Mint? Go ahead, ask.
What are the improvements in Linux Mint?
There we go. So they've made some updates to drivers and the update manager itself, software sources, some cosmetic improvements. They've overall made it faster. One of the things that the update manager and the driver manager used to do is it used to check to see if there was an internet connection before it did anything. And that would take a little bit of time, some milliseconds or some seconds, depending on how fast your computer and your network connection is. Mm-hmm. But what they've done is they've eliminated that check. So it immediately kicks in. And if there then checks, I'm presuming, because if then you don't have an internet connection, the network, or rather the driver manager, which, of course, you need to be able to install a network driver if you've got an oddball network card and it doesn't work out of the box. One of the hangups before was when you go to the driver manager, it checks for an internet connection, and then it says, can't install the driver manager because for the internet connection because you don't have an internet connection. Well, by not checking for that internet connection, what it allows you to do is it allows you to use the install CD or DVD or USB stick that you use for the installation as your software sources. And then you can install that network driver from there. Nice. So it's a little better way of, it just makes sense, right? A little better way of managing things. Also, let's see, they've changed the way that available kernels are displayed, allows you to select from which kernel you want to use if there's been a kernel update. And now there's also a warning in that whole software installation process that's a little clearer that tells you that enabling backports and the unstable repositories may cause problems. Of course, they're not enabled by default, but there's a warning there that if you check this box, you may be causing yourself some problems. They made some changes to the login screen, made it a lot prettier. You can now go into recovery mode using Control-Alt-F1 if things fail right on that boot up screen.
That's handy.
The welcome screen is faster. Shutdown sequence was fixed. I don't know what was broken, but they say it's fixed. And they've replaced the historic XChat as the default IRC chat client with something called HexChat, HexChat. It's not the British way of saying H. It's HexChat.
By the way,
why did they do that, I wonder?
By the way,
I don't know.
I've been a little remiss here. By the way, if you want to follow along with everything we're talking about on tonight's show, just go to our show notes at computeramerica.com. And you'll see today's show, which is May the 20th. You'll see Larry's name up there and his Going Linux podcast. But we have a link. So we have two links there. We have the show notes and we have the email link. Both of them are there. So you just click on it and you can follow along. And all the links are there as well. So you can just continue to follow along everything we're doing. Okay, continue on.
Right. So that was HexChat. We can go into maybe after the break a little some of the additional benefits of the new version of Mint 17. There are quite a few little improvements that make things a lot better in Mint 17. The upgrade to Ubuntu was met with a resounding yawn, but I don't think that the Mint 17 will be panned by the reviewers. But before we do any of that, well, we've got a few minutes before the break. Charles, maybe you can help me a little bit with this network thing. So if I click here on the network connection, you see I have a Pro XPN, and if I try to turn it on, it fails.
Oh, shouldn't do that right now.
Well, this is virtual machine inside of another, so.
Ah, okay. So double click on the VPN connection. Let me see what you got in there for your connection stuff.
Okay, so what I've got is the server, the Los Angeles server, which is where I'm located. I've got my username for ProXPN. I've got my password for ProXPN. No, I'm not going to
click the little show password.
And then you go into PPTP advanced options.
Okay, I'm looking
at enable this. I had to select a secure
select all available. You should probably select all available because then it'll rotate through them unless you have specific instructions. I don't remember mine.
No, there were no specific instructions there. Mm-hmm. I do remember reading on the website, though, that it was 128-bit encryption. That's why I chose that, but we'll just leave it with the default.
Okay.
The instructions that Ferdy sent to me said specifically allow stateful encryption, which I did.
Right. Uh-huh.
It also said allow encrypt compression.
Right.
It didn't say which kind of compression, so I left them all. It didn't say anything about PPP echo packets.
So are you saying you're feeling a little compressed?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, did he tell you anything about the PAP and the CHAP and everything else? Go back into advanced?
No, he didn't say anything there. Now, when you unclick this, it allows you to make those selections. But if you notice, they're grayed out.
When you click that.
Yeah, so these two are selected by default.
Sure.
He didn't say anything about that, so I left it as it was.
Okay.
And let's now see if that one change we made will actually allow me to connect. So let's see if it will work. So we'll turn that on.
Turn the VPN on. Let's see if we get an error message.
Yeah.
It's trying.
It is trying.
Thinking about it. Wait for it.
It's thinking about it. It's
wait for
thinking about
it.
Maybe it'll think about maybe doing something. Maybe.
Yeah, I think it's going to work.
Oh, you think? It's taken longer than before.
Yeah.
It stayed on.
It looks like it's running.
It's working.
Okay. So that is...
Now here's a
check. That's a secret.
It works.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. You were all week.
Got the approval. So we have... I'll update the instructions in the notes to reflect the advanced settings that we just chose. And again, this is... the network manager settings that come in Linux Mint 17 by default. So we had to do nothing but sign up for ProXPN and then use those settings for this setup.
Nice.
Yeah, and what you do, just it's in the instructions, but you click on here, you choose VPN from this list, click create, and it defaults to PPTP. And then you just hit create and follow the rest of the instructions. And that's how we got to where we are here.
Nice.
And I've also got in the show notes, I've got the a list of the various pro servers that they have, the VPN host names for their servers.
Okay.
So they've got one in the UK, one Seattle, Singapore, a couple in New York, one in the Netherlands, Miami, LA.
You don't want to use the one
Dallas
in
Dallas and Czech.
You don't want to use the one in Dallas too, because that's the Dallas one is for the free accounts and that's really slow.
Yeah, they have a PPTP one there as well. I'm assuming it's a separate server. But,
okay, all right.
But anyway, they also give you the IP addresses of those things, so you could actually compare it with the free IP address, I guess. So anyway, that wraps up our setting up of VPN on Linux Mint 17.
See,
went quite easily, just that easily. And it all came with out-of-the-box software tools from Linux Mint. You didn't have to do anything special.
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing special. So we got about 5 minutes left. Shall we continue on our review of Mint 17?
Sure.
Why not? I'm actually pretty interested in this.
Oh. Yeah. So some of the things specific to Cinnamon, let's take a look at some of those. They've got the new Cinnamon 2.2 desktop. Some of the things they list in the list of new features haven't been activated yet in the release candidate. In particular, the one that I have been missing since the days of GNOME 2 has been, or rather since I switched to Cinnamon from the mate version, is the ability to control scroll wheel to zoom in and out.
Oh, that's nice.
They're bringing that back, but it's not in the release candidate. I haven't been able to find the settings for it, or I would enable that, and then we could just zoom in and out on the screen. But that either it's not in there because it's the live version, or it's not in there because it's not ready yet, or it's not in there because it doesn't work in a virtual machine.
You know, you know what I like about this is I can do that scroll wheel zooming in and out because I have a Logitech mouse, and the Logitech mouse allows you to literally define any function for any button, including the scroll wheel. So if you want to make the scroll wheel zoom in and out, you certainly can do that. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and one of the things that they still do have is under the accessibility settings, they have the ability to do a zoom use Alt Super, which is the Windows key or the Command key on a Mac, Alt Super 8, the number 8. That turns it on, toggles it on, and let me see if I can do that now. Alt 8. So that should have toggled that on, and now I should be able to zoom in, and it is not, it's not working right now. So unless I had it on and
you turned it off.
And I turned it off. Nope. But it does let you step in and out, so it's not a smooth zoom like the scroll wheel does.
Now that,
so
I see
that zoom's been around for a while in Cinnamon.
It says off, though. Don't you have to turn it on and see that the slider
is
on?
Yeah, well, the Alt Super 8 should turn it on.
Well, just click
I
and see.
Manually turn it on.
Oh, okay.
I think. So, on.
Yeah.
There we go.
Okay.
Let's see if it actually works now. I know we're coming up on the break here.
Yeah, I know.
No, not working.
Okay. Well, we'll figure it out. Anyway, when we come back from the break, we're going to switch gears, if you will, and we're going to head over to some email, Computer America feedback for the show. Email what Larry does is he gets emails over the month, and then he picks what he feels would be of interest to most everybody, and then we read them and answer email questions. There's even one from Nancy. I don't think it's Nancy Gate, but there is even one from Nancy.
It's the same Nancy.
The same Nancy. All right. So there's.
It is,
yeah.
Indeed.
All right. So we're going to be doing
Charles, a VPN connection drops.
Exactly.
Oh.
So there we go. All right. So we're going to continue on.
Well, I think
on.
There's a time threshold for the free version, but I don't know.
Coming up in hour two. Well, use the code COMPM, and it won't be free anymore. You get it. That's it. You get the paid version. This is the Computer America Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, on the Boost Radio Network, and the IRN Radio Network. It's our All Linux Show with Larry Bushy. We will be right back. Stay with us.
Computers run the world, and we run computers. Call us or send us an email to live@computeramerica.com.
Hello and welcome into hour two of the nation's longest-running, nationally syndicated radio talk show on computers. This is the Computer America Show, and I'm your host,
the great and powerful Craig Rossman.
Fail. Fail. That's you using your powers for evil and not for good. I'm your co-host, certified ethical hacker, except for when I hack into Craig's computer, Charles Kendall.
Hey, and we're back with hour two of the Computer America Show. Larry Bushy, host of the Going Linux podcast, continues on with us. In the first hour, we were talking about using a VPN on Linux. We were talking about ProXPN, and they are really a terrific product. And they work with a Windows machine, they work with a Mac, and they will also work with a Linux system. And we're talking about using a ProXPN or a VPN, which protects who you are and where you are, so people can't really find out, you know, who you are and where you're calling from. And it's so much more than that, because it gives you access to websites, from overseas where you might not normally be able to get. It just has a lot of terrific values. If you missed any of that, you certainly can listen to it again. We archive all of our shows at blogtalkradio.com/computeramerica. You can listen to all of our shows there. And, of course, you can also watch the show on our live video streaming page. So now we're going to switch gears, and we're going to talk about some of the emails that we get. And again, you can follow along with this. Just go to our show notes page at computeramerica.com. You look at today's show date, 5/20, and you'll see the show notes link, and now we're going to click the email link, and you can read along, with us if you would like. We're going to start off here from somebody named Lee, who is asking for advice.
Yeah, imagine that. Somebody writes into the Going Linux podcast asking for advice.
Yeah.
It's probably about Linux, too.
Yeah.
So moving mother-in-law off of Windows XP was the title of the email.
Mm-hmm.
He writes, "Hello, Larry and Bill." Of course, for new listeners, Bill is my co-host on the Going Linux podcast. Mm-hmm. "My mother-in-law is using Windows XP. Sorry for the dreaded W word. She is not very computer savvy and only wants her computer to work when she turns it on." Mm-hmm. Well, that's what most people want.
Yeah, really. I want my computer to work even when I don't turn it on. You know,
exactly. I think the point is she just wants it to simply work when she turns it on.
Oh, yeah.
"I am trying to get her to try Linux, but she is resistant to change."
No.
I use Linux Mint 16 Cinnamon and love it. Well, that's the version that I'm using right now, at least until 17 comes out. "What distro do you think will give her the closest feel to what she has now? Any help you can give me in resolving this matter? will be appreciated. So, Lee, here's my recommendation. I recommend that you download Linux Mint 16 right now. If you wait until a little bit later in the month, download Linux Mint 17, but get the Mate version, the Mate version, M-A-T-E, rather than Cinnamon.
Start her off with 1.0. I mean, that'll work away. Yeah,
there you go. Windows 1.0?
Linux 1.0.
So the reason I'm suggesting that particular version is because that version comes with a Windows XP theme available for it, and it's quite convincing, actually. You can download the theme and install it on there, and you'll get the Fisher-Price user interface. If you copy the background, the wallpaper, you can even get that wonderful, what Microsoft called Bliss wallpaper, you know, the rolling green hills and the blue sky and the fluffy white clouds. And everything will look like Windows XP. Of course, it will be Linux. It will behave like Linux. You'll have the security of Linux, but oftentimes the resistance to change has less to do with reality and more to do with perception. And if she can see that this looks like her old computer, kind of behaves like her old computer, you still have the start menu, still click on it, you still go to software there. Instead of clicking on the big blue E to get on the internet, you click on the Firefox logo, but maybe she's already got Firefox installed. And that would be what I would recommend as a Linux distribution for your mother-in-law. Now, Windows XP, although it's officially dead or unsupported, it's probably still okay for a while, especially as long as the antivirus software vendors continue to develop and support their software, unless you believe what Symantec said recently. Did you hear that, by the way, Charles, what Symantec said about antivirus software?
No.
Yeah, they made a comment about it not being any good.
Antivirus software? Well,
antivirus. True. Yeah. 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 So anyway, even though XP is at end of life, it's still okay for a while. And so what I would do is, if your mother-in-law is still using things like Internet Explorer and still using things like Microsoft Office, Starter Edition or whatever they called it, you know, with the ads embedded in it. Mm-hmm. Try switching her to open source software equivalents that would appear in Linux. So don't change her computer at first. Just say, look, instead of using Internet Explorer, I'd like you to use something a little more secure. Let's use Firefox. That's a good secure one. And then you get her set up on Firefox, or even Google Chrome, they get her set up there. And then once she's using that, switch her over if she's using the Office Suite at all, and she may not be at all. It may just be using browser and games and stuff in the browser. But if she's using an Office Suite, switch her over to LibreOffice, which is available for Windows as well. And then gradually, as she gets used to those two things, you can then say, you know what, Windows XP is no longer supported and we're not getting security updates. I'm a little worried about security. I'd like to make a minor little change to add some security. Install Mint with Mate, with the Windows XP theme, with Firefox, and it'll come with LibreOffice. And if she never touches this, you know, add remove programs in Windows, or never touches the settings, she won't even know that it's different. She'll just click on the Firefox icon and go and do her Sudoku or whatever she does. checks email, you know, that kind of stuff. Goes on YouTube and watches videos. There you go. So that's my recommendation, Lee.
All right.
Actually, you know, Larry, have you played with GNOME 3?
GNOME 3, yes, I have. Yes, I have.
What's your opinion of that guy?
It's been a while, and I know it's changed a little bit, but when I tried it, it had kind of the Mac-style universal menu,
yeah.
Which I don't know whether they're still sticking to that or not. I kind of like the Mac style universal menu, but for people who don't, it would be very annoying. But overall, I liked GNOME 3. It looked to be simple, you know, just straightforward, stripped down. Not a lot of bloat in it, you know, and it's been, like I said, it's been a little while, so they've had time to add some bloat to it. But I like it. I did like it. I just like some of the additional tweaks and settings that Cinnamon gives me. And until I find something better, I'll stick with Cinnamon. The Unity interface from Ubuntu is kind of growing on me. GNOME 3 is kind of growing on me, but not to the point where I'd switch from Cinnamon yet.
Okay.
How about you?
I started trying it in 13.10, and I liked it. You know, it was very minimalist, and that was my favorite part of the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but it was just I had gotten used to Unity. I know, cringe, but you know, it was an interesting switch, and I like it. But I'm probably going to stay Unity for myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can see why. Unity does, it grows on you.
Yeah, grows on you.
If you like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Unity sticks there. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. So, shall we go on to Thor's email?
Now, this one makes me nervous because at first glance, this looks like it's really a technical.
It is.
It's super hyper technical question.
Well, maybe. Yeah, maybe. I'll see if I can simplify it a little bit for the Linux neophytes. This actually was from our Google Plus community, and I've got Thor's original post and at least one of the responses. Mm-hmm. And so although we have a technical question, we have a technical answer. So this is kind of an example of what goes on in the Going Linux Google Plus community. You'll never find this on Twitter.
So technically, this is going to be technical.
Yes, of course.
All right.
So Thor wrote, "Can someone help me with my script?
Ah!
It's a mess of pipes, but it almost works. All I need is a way to remove the last four characters of a string. He's got a script to remove the last four characters of a string. Open it in a text editor, remove the last four characters, and save it.
You got it. He must have a several.
Yeah,
things that
that's the point. Yeah. That's the point. So he writes, I need to convert a large amount of .svg files to .png. Those are.
He wants to do a batch file. He wants to do a batch file type of thing.
He wants to do kind of a batch file. And that's what a script is in Linux world, in Unix world. Inkscape can do it, but I'm not going to do it one by one. So Inkscape is a graphics program that you can use to draw vector graphics, to save them as individual bitmap images, and you can convert them from one to another. And essentially what he wants to do is convert these SVG images to PNG images, be done with it.
Well, I know Adobe, has even in their least expensive package, they allow you to do multiple batch files at one time.
Sure.
So wouldn't GIMP or something like that have something like that?
No.
No?
Yes. No. Yeah.
Okay.
Adobe will do it in a batch. Inkscape should be able to do it in a batch, but it can't. The GIMP program, it's for bitmap images, so it wouldn't take it'll take the SVG images and convert them, but it doesn't do them in a batch.
Mm-hmm.
So Thor writes out what his script is so far. And if you read through it, what he's doing is he's listing the list, which in batch programming under Windows would be DIR, directory.
Mm-hmm.
And then cat, which prints or sends the file to as text. And the next part of the script says search for .svg. And while reading the file, do Inkscape, export the file as PNG, and then done. So he lists the files in the folder. He looks for the SVG files and has this script converting them to PNGs, but it's not working. He says, this does the job, but the output ends up with .svg.png suffix. So if I could strip off the SVG, then it would be perfect. Mm. Any ideas? Right?
I'm looking at the script now.
Uh-huh.
What he should do, let me see. And he's catting to grep.svg, send NE. He should be doing a copy. It'll convert it. Well, he's trying to convert.
Yes, and that's why he's got Inkscape in the list there. So he's using Inkscape in the command line. Inkscape will do the conversion one at a time. So he's using a script to automate it. So later on, Thor provided an update on Google Plus. He says he figured it out with the help of a video. We've got a link in the show notes to the video using a command line command called sed, S-E-D. And so his modified script does the same thing. He lists the files that end in SVG. Then instead of using grep, he uses sed to take the file, strip off the SVG, do the conversion, and convert it over to PNG. Yeah. It outputs all PNG images to a folder called PNG. However, Mark later responded and said, use this script instead. It's safer.
Safer
and
how? How is it?
It's much more complex and something that a neophyte script writer would never have been able to figure out. But Mark is obviously someone who deals with these kinds of things on a regular basis. He says it's important to consider spaces in file names. Thus, if the IFS equals, so in other words, if there's a space in the file name, the script that Thor originally wrote would break. It wouldn't work properly. Mm. So what Mark has done in his script is he's checked for spaces. Ah. In the file name, and has allowed for it in his script. So that's what makes it a little bit safer. Right. He says, also, you should double quote the places you reference in the file variable.
Hmm.
So double quotes in scripting in Linux have a special meaning when you're dealing with text files, which is what this is. So by double quoting the file name, it ensures that the script doesn't get confused as to some of the characters, like the dollar sign, that can mean different things depending on the context. So by using the double quotes, you're basically saying, hey, this is a file variable. So and don't mistake it for something else. He says it's also not recommended to parse the output of the ls command. You should use find instead. So instead of using the directory command or the list command in Linux, Mark is saying use find instead. So don't list the files, find the files. It's a little bit safer. And that's kind of sage advice from someone who's done scripting for a while.
It's very subtle. It's very subtle.
And Mark provides a link to a tip that's actually posted on Twitter. And Jack replied to this whole string saying, I use Pi Renamer. So there's a whole other program that lets you do this batch renaming. It's already out there. It's called Pi Renamer, and it's a Python script that's already written for you. Just use it.
Yeah.
Still love the way folks on this group jump in to help.
Yeah.
There is more than one way to execute a task.
There you go.
So did that very technical Google Plus post workout, Craig, do you think, or was it too in-depth for this audience?
No, I think not. I think that, and again, you know, it also helps to be able to look at it, too. So, you know, again, in the show notes, you can see all of this at computeramerica.com, just under our show notes. You can see all these things and follow along. And you can listen to the show again. You can listen to the archive and kind of follow along with us.
Follow right along.
That's, exactly.
It's all there. I've tried to use monospace type in the Google Docs so that you can kind of follow along. It looks more like it does in the command line. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that works.
Okay, so now we're going to move to this next email, and we're going to go visit Nancy Gate.
Yeah, so this isn't the I can't get my money program to work anymore. This same Nancy, though, she wants some advice with her MacBook.
Yeah, because she
is a Linux show.
You know, yeah, Nancy was, for those of you who are listening, she wasn't going to convert over to Quicken because over to Linux because she couldn't get Quicken to run on Linux, and that was the whole.
Yeah, and she couldn't find an equivalent program that did the things that she needed to do based on how she uses Quicken. So
now she wants advice with a MacBook. What is she asking a Linux guy?
Well, let's dig into this and see. There's a Linux bent to this.
All right.
Hi guys, I've written before about my antique IBM Lenovo laptop running SUSE Linux. Well, I've got it just like I like it. You know what's coming now, right? Now I'm going to tinker with it. Okay. I've got it just like I like it. I haven't messed with it in a while. I've moved into a new house on our property, and it's still up in the old house, meaning the old computer is still up in the old house. Mm-hmm. Since I've consolidated all my computing onto my MacBook, I created a new install of the same version of OpenSUSE that I have on the Relic ThinkPad computer. Uh-huh. I wanted to know, how can I get my programs and files over to the new machine? Uh-huh. I don't have the installation programs for a couple of them, and I can't find them anymore. I know one came from an older repository, and I believe they've taken that one down. They left 2 and 4, but 3 is gone. Without a registry, this should be a very simple process, right? What I wanted to do was to create a virtual machine file from the SUSE machine, but I know that's not a fun process, and I couldn't find instructions for it. So is it as simple as moving folders and overwriting what's in the new installation? How can I tell which folders I need? The other issue I've had is the resolution totally vacuums. It sucks. In Parallels, and the Parallels tools installation for this guest has really been difficult. Since you can't run Parallels and VirtualBox at the same time, they compete with each other for control of whatever Parallels calls hypervisor or something like that. I want to get SUSE onto Parallels so I don't have to shut down my Windows installation in order to start up my SUSE installation.
Nancy likes really stirring things up, doesn't she?
She does.
Oh, gosh. Gosh bless her.
So she wants to take, she's got hardware install of Linux Mint. She's got it set just the way she likes it. Mm-hmm. She wants it in a virtual machine on her Mac. She's got a virtual machine installed with a newer version of OpenSUSE. She says the same version of OpenSUSE. So she's using that same older version. And now she's got that set up. She's done the install. Now she can't find some of the programs, and she wants to know, how can she move this stuff over? Mm. Well, any thoughts, Charles, before I weigh in on this one?
Say again.
Okay, I was afraid of that. So,
well, the OpenSUSE, what it sounds like to me from the portions that I caught was, let me make sure, she's got Parallels installed.
Yeah.
She's trying to run OpenSUSE in Parallels. There's one problem there. Parallels by itself is its virtualization, but it's more leaning toward the Windows environment and to more mainstream OSs. Mm-hmm. So she might be better off. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Craig. Parallels is the one where it's dual boot, isn't it? Or is that boot camp?
No, boot camp is a dual boot. You have to shut it down and run it. But where Parallels, you can let everything run, and you can start multiple sessions, and not have to reboot.
What I would recommend she do is she uninstall Parallels and try VirtualBox. I know she said that they collide with one another, but that might work. You know, or even still try the VMware tools one. That works out good. I know that was it Parallels or was it VMware Fusion? One of the two of them had gotten together and had actually made software bridges for the for the Mac hardware. Like, it was specifically written to make the, to bridge the gap there. She may also want to check out trying to run that OpenSUSE from a USB disk on her MacBook directly to see if she's running into any types of hardware conflicts there. Now, what version did she say she was running?
I don't think she said which version it is. She just said it was an old version, though.
Yeah. See, the older you get, the harder it's going to be to get, you know, compatibility,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
So I don't understand. Is there a reason why she's going after OpenSUSE as opposed to going after, you know?
Yeah, she's got it set up on her old laptop, and she's got it tweaked exactly how she likes it. She doesn't want to mess with it anymore. She likes it the way it is. She wants to move it over onto her Mac.
So she wants to... Okay, there is for VirtualBox, yeah. At least. I don't know about in Parallels, and it depends on whether or not there's a tool, probably is, to convert these. With VirtualBox, you can actually do what's called P2V, or a physical to a virtual machine, where yeah. It actually clones the hard drive and then sucks that over. You know,
right.
That she might want to try that.
Yeah, I've got something even simpler.
Oh, DD?
No. You hit on it with the word clone.
So
you take your IBM laptop and you get a copy of CloneZilla. You clone the hard drive, the partitions, to an external hard disk. So now you have a backup as an image file.
Right.
Then you install VirtualBox on your Mac. And then you get your copy of CloneZilla, plug in your USB hard drive with the backup on it, enable the USB pass-through on VirtualBox. Now you boot to CloneZilla and restore from the backup. All you need is a VirtualBox virtual hard drive, the same size or larger than the one that was on the ThinkPad, and Bob's your uncle, you've got an exact copy of everything that was on the ThinkPad. Now, you would never be able to do that with Windows, because Windows would say, wait a minute, I just woke up and the video driver's different, the hard drive's different, everything's different, I can't run. This isn't a genuine copy of Windows. But with Linux, most of the drivers are built into the kernel, and as soon as you boot into it, it sees all the hardware and says, oh, well, this isn't the right driver. We got to switch to this driver. This one isn't the right driver. We got to switch to this. And it takes care of all that. So there may be a few things. If you've got if you've got something that's a non-standard hardware on that ThinkPad that you've installed a driver manually, you may have to reset that up. But that would be probably the quickest and the easiest way to make the transition, assuming you haven't done too much manual hardware configuration on the ThinkPad. So either way will work, but that last way, doing the clone, ensures that you don't have to go hunt down old repositories and obsolete copies of software to be able to install it on your new installation, even though it's an older version of Linux, of OpenSUSE. Sometimes trying to install stuff that's no longer supported, no longer even available, can be a problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's a good suggestion. And you think Nancy's she's still running Quicken on her MacBook. That's probably why she still has the MacBook.
Yeah, it's probably it. And, you know, that's more power to her. One thing I did notice, though, in the latest version of VirtualBox, with running VirtualBox on a Windows host, you could do where you run it like it runs in Parallels on a Mac. You could run Linux as I wish I could remember the term. What's it called when you open the application in a Mac VM and it and it opens a window of the Windows program. I'll look it up while we're at the break. Not full screen mode. It's
Oh, no.
We'll figure it out.
No.
Yeah.
All right. Is this a, it's a parallels term?
It's a parallels term. It works in virtual box.
I know.
Virtual box.
All right.
Well,
I'll think of it in a minute. Hey, listen, we got to take a break. This is the Computer America Show. We got the London Minute coming up. We'll be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to Computer America.
This is your London Minute voice memo. I'm feeling a bit like Jenny Lee in Call the Midwife. No babies to deliver, but I do reduce stress on my home visits as a computer trainer. What are my biggest challenges? The breech birth of computing? Well, as you're asking, on a bad day it's scary dogs and unexpected pornography. And don't ask me about the Randy Yorkshire Terrier. Let's just say it was hashtag awkward. Other challenges involve explaining that learning the computer is a layered affair. It can't be done in an hour or two. So often, it's not what I've said, but what I have held back for another day, maybe never. Too much too soon will result in a digital retreat, and the computer will be shut down. Slow and steady always wins the race. I help filter out the noise and the clatter that is social media and apps which, let's face it, are up to our eyeballs. As those listening on Computer America are more likely to be the ones helping rather than the ones in need, here are some tips to help those less confident with computing. Slow down. Digital native family members love rushing in, fixing something in a hurry, a little in secret, and then like dashing off. When I speak with new clients, it's the most common complaint I hear. Don't give them fish, but teach them to cook. Remember the former Pope who didn't send his first tweet? He got fish. What's right for you might be all wrong for the person you're helping. LinkedIn is not suitable for all generations, neither is Snapchat. Avoid jargon. Does your mother really need to know the difference between POP and IMAP? If you see a glazed look coming back at you, for goodness sake, stop. If you want to hear more from me, catch me over in Avast, the antivirus. Set your language settings to UK English, and ta-da! I'll be announcing that your scan has been completed. And I might feel it necessary to say, threat has been detected. I'll see you over on Twitter. I'm at Computer Tweety. This is Patricia Reichel for Computer America.
And thanks for that, Patricia. Welcome back to the Computer America Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Boost Radio Network and the IRN Radio Network. We are talking to Larry Bushy. We are doing our emails portion of the Computer America Show. You were trying to find, Larry, the term that allows Parallels to run more than one operating system but on the same desktop, and they call that coherence.
That right, is- and under VirtualBox, it's called seamless mode. And the point I was going to make is, up until the most recent version of VirtualBox, under a Windows, at least Windows XP host, and a Linux client, I could never get seamless mode, I could get seamless mode to work just fine. So I'd be running Linux in a VirtualBox virtual machine and would be able to open gedit or, you know, a Linux program, and it would look like it's running in a Windows window. Well, running a Linux guest on a Linux host, I could never get that to work. What I did notice this time after I updated VirtualBox to be able to install Linux Mint 17 is that I accidentally hit the key combination to go into seamless mode, and it worked. So whatever they had that wasn't allowing seamless mode with Linux on Linux is working just fine now. So you may even be able to run seamless mode on a Mac using VirtualBox running Linux on the Mac.
Yeah.
So
I like
that. Would
yeah, I like the coherence. I mean because then you don't really care what operating system you're running in. You double click on an icon and it opens
and
up
it runs,
and you're
yeah.
running and you don't have to worry about well now I'm in Windows or I'm in this or I'm in that. It just runs, you know, which
right.
is just really so slick. It was one of the exactly. coolest features I thought of from Parallels when they introduced
yeah.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool. Pretty cool. So next email is from Mark.
He has a recommendation for Mint users.
He does indeed.
Mm-hmm.
He writes, "Hi Larry and Bill, I listen to your podcast regularly now for about 2 years. I am still a novice Linux user, but I am learning in part due to your podcast. My question is, have either of you ever heard of a Linux distro called SolidXK? I found it about a year ago and absolutely love it. It is at www.solidxk.com, and solid is spelled with a Y instead of an I, SolidXK.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rolling release, very similar to Linux Mint Debian Edition, with quarterly update packs. It has two primary desktop environments, KDE and XFCE. I am currently running XFCE. Please pass along to other listeners that if anyone wants a good, easy Linux distro to begin learning with, or just try out, I would recommend SolidXK. P.S. It has only been around for about 14 months, but thanks to word of mouth, podcasts, social media, etc., SolidXK Linux is growing in popularity. Thanks again for the wonderful podcast. Keep up the good work."
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. So
well, talk about being both ends of the spectrum. You've got the fastest, lightest desktop environment on the planet, and
yep.
then you've got KDE, which is the Titanic of desktop environments.
Right, right. So it's got something for everybody.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And he mentions the fact that it's very much like Linux Mint Debian. Well, and there's a good reason for that. It's the Solid XK was developed by one of the people who originally worked on Linux Mint Debian before they changed the philosophy.
Oh.
And he decided that he would continue the original Linux Mint rolling release philosophy with Solid XK when Clem over at Linux Mint decided that he wanted to change the way that the rolling release worked. So Solid XK with KDE or XFCE is essentially a fork of Linux Mint Debian Edition. Then they've taken the KDE version and the XFCE version and continued on with those, continued to develop those. And they've got, I have to say, some of the nicest looking KDE desktops that I have seen. Some nice, clean, not too complex, which is, complex is very easy to do on KDE, as you know. They've made it clean, easy to understand, as you can with KDE. It's just a good looking desktop. And XFCE, like you said, is stripped down fast, runs well. You can get XFCE and KDE on Linux Mint as well, but, you can get XFCE on Linux Mint, but the KDE version of Linux Mint has gone off and there's another organization that's supporting that. It's still Mint with KDE, but it's not one of the primary main editions of Linux Mint anymore. There's just the Mate version, the Cinnamon version, and the XFCE version are the three main versions. So SolidXK, good solid, pardon the pun, mm-hmm. distribution. It's your traditional rolling release. It gets the updates as they're ready. You install it once. You never have to reinstall because you just get the updates and the upgrades and all that as they come out.
Very cool. Now, this next one I can relate to. The Jack Death email. and I certain time because, you know, Charles will say OS X, That drives me crazy.
OSX.
Well, evidently, Charles, I'm not the only one you're doing this to.
Yeah. So this is from Jack Def. Yes, the Jack Def. It's normally in the chat room. He writes with a message for Charles. He didn't send it to you directly, Charles. He had to go through me. I'm not sure why, but here it is. Larry, you will probably laugh at me, but after listening to Charles on the Computer America show several times now, over and over, pronouncing Ubuntu as Ubuntu, it finally drove me to the point of insanity. Seriously? Every time he says it now, it makes me want to claw my own ears off and feed them to a wandering rabid gnu or an insane cannibalistic tree frog. He's got away with words, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Or at least, at the very least, I want to bludgeon myself to death with a large fur cucumber.
Man, these are interesting.
So the next time you talk to him, please share this link with him. It's in the show notes.
Yeah.
It's this is how you pronounce Ubuntu.
Do they have another
Ubuntu?
Do they have another one like that? Says how do you pronounce OS X?
OS X.
So click the link, open it up, listen to the audio file, and that's how you're supposed to say it. Anyway,
potato.
What the site doesn't mention, unless I missed something, is that Ubuntu is an African word when roughly translated means humanity to others or humanity and compassion towards others or some such thing.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons when Canonical first came up with it as a name for their version of Linux, they used to call it Linux for human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. If you listen to how most African words are pronounced, it would just make sense that it would be pronounced Ubuntu. All right, I feel better now that I vented. Cheers, Troy, a.k.a. Jack Def.
You know, it makes me happy that I'm not the only one out there.
Well, I'm sorry. You know, I've got one computer that runs OS X and the other one that runs Ubuntu.
He's not going to change.
I got a third computer that runs Ubuntu.
Ubuntu.
Ubuntu. Ubuntu. And then I've got another computer that still runs OS X.
Yeah. And mine runs Linux Mint.
Linux. Yeah.
Linux.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, Jack, listen, as you see that you're not alone, and these are just some of the things you have to put up with when you listen to the show.
Yeah, he's not in the.
I noticed. Yeah,
he's not in the chat room tonight, but hopefully he's.
I think
say it and run.
Exactly.
He's been up in the chat room for a while now.
Now, what did you say, Charles?
It's not that bad. I mean, if you think about it, it's one of those things where it's like, you know, people say things differently, but you know, Jack, we will find you.
We know where you hang out.
Charles
right?
is going to record an audio.
No, he's just gonna send you a link that you want you to click on, Jack.
Click the link, Jack. Click the link.
Okay.
The world is a good place when you click the link that troll sends you.
Okay, so now we head all the way down to Perth, Australia, where I guess they don't care how you pronounce anything. And there. Sorry, it was just a little humor. It was just a joke. Wrote about Linux on Chromebooks.
All right.
I mean, I go to the Outback restaurant, and I think the accent is quite charming, actually. So that's it, you know.
Yeah. Well,
Craig hasn't told you the story about him being in an Outback and someone like being like, you know, who are you? And being like, I'm Craig Crossman. I don't care who you are. Go away. He was like, I was talking on his cell phone or something.
Oh gosh. Yeah, that was a long story, a long time ago.
Okay.
Anyway,
well, this is a short story from Andrew from Perth. Larry, The other week, Chris from Linux Action Show did a Chromebook challenge, and one of the things he mentioned was that to put anything other than Chrome OS on it, you need to set development mode in the BIOS, kind of like Android. He did also mention in a later episode of Unplugged, I think, another one of the podcasts that Chris does, that you do run the risk of bricking the unit if it fails. This might be why you have had some problems loading Krubuntu, Andrew from Perth, Australia. And he provides a link to the Jupiter Broadcasting website where Chris Fisher of the Linux Action Show houses all of his 5,492 different podcasts on everything from Linux to BSD to, you know, he does a lot of, I don't know where he finds the time, but he does. So there's a link there. And my feedback to Andrew is that my challenge installing Krubuntu on my Chromebook had more to do with, I think, the fact that I was trying to use an image. They use image files for loading these things. I was trying to use an image that wasn't quite the right release version. And it was close, but no cigar, and it just wouldn't work. So the whole thing about bricking, though, if you've listened to the Linux Action Show episode where Chris talks about that, he was talking about bricking the Chromebook because he removed Chrome OS, then installed Ubuntu on the hardware.
Ooh.
And then he was saying, if you then uninstall Ubuntu, you've bricked the system because you've got nothing to boot to.
Yep.
So it's very easy. As long as you have the original Chrome OS that came with the device on there, you haven't removed the ability to go into developer mode. To restore a Chrome machine is essentially download a file from the internet on the Chrome OS website. It's an image for your machine. You pick the right one from the model you have. You put it on a thumb drive. It wipes out everything on the thumb drive with the image, and it's a restore image. So there's no restore partition or anything on a Chromebook. But you can easily download the latest image for your machine, pop into developer mode. Actually, you don't ever go into developer mode. You just go into a recovery mode, which then if you go into that mode with the USB stick with the image on it already installed before you go into that mode, when you boot it, it starts the recovery almost automatically for you. So it wipes everything out on the machine, restores the factory image, and it's as though you got it brand new out of the box again. When I got my Chromebook, the one I have now is my second Chromebook, same model, same everything, except the vendor I bought it from. The first one I got, there was something wrong with it, and it would not find a wireless connection. And of course, with a Chromebook, there is no wired connection.
Yeah.
There must have been something wrong with the wireless, the Wi-Fi radio in the device. So I sent it back, got a new one. But before I sent it back, I actually went onto my Linux computer, downloaded the image to a thumb drive, and did the restore thing. And restoring from a factory image was very, very simple, very easy, but it didn't fix the problem. That's how I knew that it was a hardware issue and not a firmware issue, so or a software issue. So, bricking it, just don't remove the Chrome OS when you install Linux, and you'll be fine. And that's essentially what I'm doing today with my Chromebook. I dual boot, if you will, between Chrome OS and Linux. What have I got on there? Ubuntu XSCE, no, LXDE edition.
See, I still haven't put that on my, done that to mine, because there's one feature that as the security guy that I am, worries me a tad bit, when you do that, you basically disable secure mode, which means at that point, anything on that laptop, anything you have stored on your Chromebook basically becomes, I can pull the hard drive, I can get all the information off of it to include passwords that are actually stored on the device. So I'm like, I'm okay with just Chrome OS.
Right. Well, and my understanding, you're absolutely right, Charles. And my understanding as well is if you run your Chrome OS in developer mode, you've disabled a lot of the security as well.
Yep.
So unless you're running it in the factory mode, you know, the out of the box consumer mode, you're taking some risk there. And with a Chromebook, you know, we're Linux users. We like to tinker. We like to tweak. If you've got a Linux user with a Chromebook, they're running it in development mode because they want to see what's happening. They want to see what's going on. They want to see what they can do with it. And, you know, if you give up a little bit of security for experimentation and something goes wrong, download a restore image and wipe it out.
Yep, go to town.
Start over, yeah. Nuke and pave.
Nuke and pave. Glass parking lot and slide away.
There you go. Okay. So
we have time for Jack. Maybe one more time for Jack. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got time for Jack. And this is not Jack Death. This is just Jack. Jack.
All right.
He also posted on Google+, has anyone experimented with Burg, B-U-R-G, as a replacement for Grub? Have you noticed something?
Yes, back.
Burg is Grub spelled backwards.
Yeah, I know.
Grub is the bootloader.
Backwards equivalent.
So Jack says, I'm curious, or either that or I have too much time on my hands. Here are a couple of things that I saw that prompted my question. I don't usually like being on the bleeding edge, but I thought that it might complement Mint 17 when it arrives. And he provides about four or five links. Describing Burg as an alternative for Grub and installing it on Ubuntu and some comments from the Ubuntu forum. And one of the posts is how to make your dual boot better with Burg, and then a link to the Burg Google code site where you can download Burg itself. So
Burg.
Burg is the word.
The Burg.
Oh, God.
So after skimming through his links, I responded to him this way. Unless you're trying this on a computer you can risk bricking, I'd wait a bit. In the November post, in your first link, George wrote, and I quote, Burg is not ready to be deployed on this many machines. It's very early in its development, and I'm sure later on, say, when they've reached a beta version, people will start looking into it. That tells me it's not even beta software at this point. That tells me I don't install it on anything.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Yes. The only place I would try this out is in a virtual machine. And then I'm not sure I would bother until I've got it at least into beta. And Jack's reply to me was, right, okay, I'll hold off. I found a YouTube video that seemed interesting as well, but not everything that looks good is good. Thanks, Larry.
Yep.
So, that's my words of advice, especially when the very first blog post that's describing how great this thing is says, it's not quite ready for prime time yet. Let's,
not at all.
Not mess with that.
Hey, Charles, he misspelled YouTube.
What?
In the very last line,
YouTube.
I found a YouTube video.
YouTube.
YouTube.
It's pronounced YouTube.
YouTube.
No. It's pronounced YouTube.
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 It's an old African word that means
right.
It means owned by Google to produce videos.
Yeah.
Videos on the internet.
Yeah. They have an old African word.
For Jack Death out there, I will do my best to pronounce it Ubuntu.
He's choking on it. He can't say it.
Ubuntu. I'm trying. Ubuntu.
I didn't
know
they had
Linux operating system mainstream built by Canonical.
I didn't know they had an old African word for videos on the internet.
Utube.
Yeah. Utube. Who knew? Who knew? You know, it's centuries ago they created that word. Who knew?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we are out of email.
Yes, we
and
are.
And we've got about 5 minutes left.
Yeah.
So how's it going, guys?
Yeah. No. So let's do a roundup again. In the first hour, we talked about VPNs, we talked about ProXPN. ProXPN.com. If you are interested in a VPN network to access using your computer to promote, anonymity and
it's pronounced anonymity.
Anonymity. Anonymity. Anonymity.
Next month, how to pronounce words from Linux.
Exactly.
Linux.
We could do a whole show on that. Yeah, exactly.
We probably could pull off an entire show.
Yeah, we could easily. And just go to proxpn.com and remember to use the coupon code COMPAM. COMPAM. Pronounce it any way you like, but COMPAM. And you'll get 20% off.
Not to be confused with Pan Am.
Yes. You get 20% off of any of the subscriptions that you choose. And it's not only just for the year, that's forever. So it really turns out to be a heck of a deal. And look, when you go online these days, you really should, do as best. Charles will tell you, you want to be as safe as you can. And certainly using a VPN will help you to achieve that goal.
Yep.
Yep, exactly. And then, of course, in the second hour, we talked about the different ways, why Linux Mint, the latest improvements to Linux Mint 17, we spoke about those. And again, you can see all those on our show notes at computeramerica.com. Larry, again, I want to thank you so much for being with us here tonight. Okay.
My pleasure.
And we look forward to seeing you next month, as usual. Of course, stay with us for the after the show, a little sign off that we do here, and all of you, I know that you're all entering on all our contests at computeramerica.com. Go to our contest page, make sure that you're registered for the show reminder winner that's every Friday. Check out all the prizes that we're giving away from Logitech, 3 great prizes. All the instructions are there. Participate in all of them. You'll have a good time. You might win something really, really nice. Everything there is completely private. It's our contest page at Computer America. That about wraps it up. What do we got coming up tonight? Oh, of course. It's going to be our Intel Sponsor Hour. And we're going to be talking to Intel about their all-in-one desktops. That's right, all-in-one desktops. That's going to be the subject for the first hour with Intel. It's the Intel Sponsor Hour. And then in hour two, we're going to have computer and technology news, and that's brought to you by Slimmer Utilities, the official optimization software of Computer America. You don't want to miss the tomorrow night show. All-in-one desktops can be a really fascinating topic, and again, from Intel. So that wraps it up. So we will see you tomorrow night. And so until tomorrow night, this is Craig Crossman hoping that your hard disk never becomes
squiffy.
Floppy.
Ubuntu.
You'll learn it.
Ubuntu.
Say OS. See you tomorrow night.
Say goodnight, Craig.
Good night, Craig.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.